Hello and welcome to the Swine Disease Reporting System. This is the report number 73, where we're going to cover the findings from the previous month, the month of February. My name is Edison Magalhães, here at the SDRS.
Hello, my name is Giovanni Trevisan at the SDRS.
Hi, my name is Guilherme, also at the SDRS.
Hello, Daniel Linhares, also with the SDRS.
And today, as I mentioned, we're going to cover the findings from the previous month, month of February, for the SDRS. But also we have the pleasure of having here today Dr. Lauren Grunzewski joining the SDRS podcast. Dr. Grunzewski is currently a veterinarian for JVS USA in the Midwest region. And she has worked as a swine veterinarian for several years, being responsible for several herds around the country. And she'll share her experience in the interpretation of the SDRS monthly findings and also some insights regarding enteric coronavirus and PRRS management control practices. Dr. Grunzewski, thanks for joining us and accepting our invitation. It's a pleasure for us to have you here today.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for the invitation to the podcast. I really appreciate being here to share some thoughts today that are going to provoke some further thoughts and discussion on some health issues that are impacting our industry. Just to give you a little bit more on my background, as was mentioned, I'm currently a veterinarian for JVS USA that's worked in the heartland of the United States across multiple states since graduating from the University of Pennsylvania in 2016. I've worked exclusively with large commercial production systems as a company veterinarian since graduation. I started out with Tyson Foods, the pork group, as a sow herd health veterinarian in Oklahoma. Then I made the move to the most challenging state for swine health, Iowa, where I was the manager of veterinarian services for Tri-Oak Foods from birth to market prior to the acquisition of the company by JVS USA in 22. So I love my job. I always want to share my knowledge with others. So again, very happy to be here today.
Happy to have you, Dr. Grunzewski. Such a great background there. So before we start to go for the discussion directly with you, let's get some updates of the SDRS. What we have there, Glenn?
Yeah, first let's share with our audience that now we have a new tool available in the SDRS. That is the Blast 2 that you guys can access through the bonus page of this report right now, but also on the cover page, if you click to the link, is go directly to the Blast 2 that you can put your PRRS virus R5 sequence that you get the results from the VDL. If you copy and paste this sequence right now in this Blast 2 that we have, you can see the similarity that this sequence has with other PRRS virus sequences that were detected previously and we have in the SDRS database. So it's a new tool that the veterinarians and the producers can use to keep track of your PRRS virus sequencing that you have and what is the similarity degree that it has with other strains that was previously detected in the field.
Guilherme, and that compares to the sequences of all the VDLs in the program, right? So it's across the VDLs.
Correct. It's across the six VDLs that we have in the SDRS project. And moving right now to our findings for the SDRS itself, for the PRRS virus first, that is the first page, positivity remains high in the winter market sites with over 38% of the submissions being positive. But for cell farms, it stays like as expected for this period with 21% of the submissions positive. But the majority of the winter market positive cases that we are having right now is coming from Iowa. There is no surprise in terms of number of hogs, and Minnesota and Indiana. And regarding the sequencing part in our database, we have an alert to the industry that for the first time we have a detection of PRRS virus L1C.5. And for you that are not familiar, the L1C variant in the new classification that we have. And this first detection was in South Carolina that was not reported before in our database, and now we could see that. And this lineage is known as this clinical outcome that has in the field in terms of impact. And it has been detected in the Eastern Corn Belt state, for example, Ohio and Indiana, with more detections than in usual in this year of 2024. But however, the detection in South Carolina raised an alert for the larger breeding herd inventories that we have in the U.S. that is located in North Carolina. And to have this detection in a finishing site in South Carolina raised an alert for the industry.
And the new tool that you have there, the BLAST, has been helped to identify and establish some of those epidemiological information there, Guilherme. So good job there on providing this information. Some important thing to keep an eye on is this detection of L1C.5 in South Carolina. How about enteric coronavirus? What do we have there, Glenn?
Yeah, for enteric coronavirus, we are having a spike in positivity for PED and also Delta coronavirus, mainly in the winter market category. For example, for PED, we had a substantial increase from 13% of positive submissions in January, for example, and right now in February, we have 21%. So it was a huge increase that we have in the winter market. And most of these positive cases is coming from Kansas, Iowa, and North Carolina regarding PED. And for in terms of our state-level monitoring that we have in the algorithms in the SDRS, Kansas is having a positivity above the expected, looking to the historical data for this specific state. And moving to the Delta coronavirus, the positivity in the state-level monitoring is above the expected for Iowa, Missouri, and also Minnesota in terms of positivity.
And do you have any comments from the advisory board about this activity of this enteric coronavirus?
Yes, our advisor mentioned that the majority of the breaks come from lateral breaks in the winter market as we have this increased positivity. And these biosecurity bridges that we have, mainly with hauling transportation, employee sharing equipment, for example, people movement, is contributing to this increase in positivity. Also, one weather fact that happened was in these last weeks in January, for example, that we have these blizzards and this poor weather that we have here in the Midwest mainly. This affected like the sanitation and also washing like chutes and also transportation. That could be one of the factors that increased this positivity in the winter market.
Good comments there. And how about the other pathogens that we have for them?
Yeah, for other pathogens, we detected some increase in the mycoplasma positivity, mainly in the cell farm. But when we run this information with our advisory, it seems that we do not have a lot of outbreaks going on in the field right now. So it's just something that is more regional that is going on. But for PCV2, we also had a mild increase in the winter market, let's say, in the positivity. But what caused a little bit of the attention was a little bit of decrease in the CT values of the submission. But none of the things is to be alert right now. It's just like some initial positivity that we have for this specific pathogen.
Thank you, Guilherme.
Very good. Thank Giovanni. Thanks, Guilherme, for bringing this overview of the SDRS findings. Dr. Gonzeski, as a member of the advisory group, you saw the discussion that we just had, some of the findings that we saw. More specifically on Delta coronavirus and PED, we are facing an increased positivity activity for those two pathogens this winter in some particular regions, with the national positivity being almost above the expected for February 2024. Why do we keep, in your opinion, having this increasing enteric coronavirus positivity annually?
Yep, I think it's a really great question, Edison. We continue to see increased positivity on a seasonal basis in the United States for both viruses, for a couple different reasons. Since the first introduction to the United States in 2013, both PED and Delta Corona have just persisted in the swine population. So that's probably first and foremost, it's just never gone away and we've never had a break. Neither virus has been eliminated. And due to the long shedding duration of the viruses, the pathogens continue to persist in the environment and find new hosts and ways to replicate. The life cycle of our commercially grown out pigs is long enough that the shedding duration is overlapping with new infections. So just continues to persist, never goes away. For this reason, the viruses also always exist at the slaughter plant, on the dock, on the holding floor. And I think this is a real point and an issue that the industry needs to address and solve if we want to improve when it comes to enteric coronaviruses. We also know that there's wildlife vectors for transmission that can spread the disease from farm to farm or lagoon to lagoon. Mm-hmm. Until we eliminate this disease from existence entirely, we're going to just continue to see the virus move across different regions, especially with seasonal migration. I think there needs to be some more research done there. I have a lot of questions, you know, on seasonal migration. How does the virus move from farm to farm in these lagoons? How do these bird populations potentially move the virus? On the second point here, I think the viruses, you know, they survive and they thrive in cool weather. It's the ideal environment to move pathogens when they're preserved in the environment. What's already been mentioned here with the cool weather, we see less compliance with biosecurity efforts, oftentimes without intention. I don't think there's any malicious intent there. Truck washes and drying processes are less likely to work in the wintertime. Car washes are less likely to be operational. Boot treads, just your shoe footwear, are more likely to harbor cold mud and snow that can easily move viruses farm to farm. And people are less likely to shower or be outside wet and extremely cold weather. I've got long hair. Think of a wet head of long hair freezing outside. It's just less than ideal. And I think that we don't give that enough consideration about how PED and Delta Corona can move seasonally. Lastly, the third thing I think here that we need to consider is manure pumping and handling. I think it's huge. Manure applicators are shared across different companies and different regions. We know that these enteric viruses survive in lagoons and deep pits. In my research just here internally, just sampling pits and lagoons, we have seen PCR positives for Delta Corona and PED over 12 months in the lagoon and in the deep pit. So we know that these manure applicators are moving. So is that virus. They spread it onto fields. They're taking this manure down the roadways. It just adds more virus to the environment, to the populations, and to our communities. So I think these are just some considerations to think about when it comes to these two viruses and the seasonal prevalence.
Mm-hmm. And just a follow-up question there. You say that the virus surviving in lagoons. Would you be able to share the regions where you did that? Is it more in cold area or is more in one area where you have farms?
Yep, so I'm primarily in the Midwest region, so we've done that sampling in Illinois and Iowa.
Yeah.
It's a lot of moving parts, right? A lot of risk factors, stuff going on to help that virus to continue to spread. But the bright side is that, well, at least we know of some of those major risk factors, right? So coming up back to you is, what can we do about it as an industry? How can we break that cycle?
This is really what we need to focus on as swine veterinarians, as an industry, solving these two very costly diseases. The first step to finding a solution for enteric coronavirus, I think, is to recognize that we have a problem to begin with. I think we are really realizing that, and we've been discussing it as swine veterinarians. PED elimination has been presented on several meetings over the past couple of years. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to achieve it, we must create a very strategic, forward-looking and stage plan approach that's going to require immense collaboration across all players and influencers in the industry. I really like the idea. I struggle with these viruses. I would love to see them go away, but I think we have to be realists about it and see if we can mitigate, you know, within the system first and then take that to the next level. So mitigating from the industry level, an integrated perspective is needed. I think it's going to require some biosecurity changes be made from those common touch points for the pigs that are hitting them. So I mentioned the slaughter plant. It absolutely must be addressed. It's the commingling point and it's the destination for all diseases that exist in the region that the plants are receiving pigs from. So I like to tell our people, you know, all diseases live in the plant. We need to be extremely tight about biosecurity as those market trucks are coming back to our sites. Mm-hmm. But I think there needs to be some stop gaps put in place to reduce the risks of diseases from making their way from the loading dock back onto the trailers, and management strategies on the plant side itself to biocontain these viruses within the plant. So I don't see too many concerted efforts there today. They're a major industry partner. There's very few slaughter plants in the country that are receiving our pigs. So let's address it now and let's see if we can mitigate some of these viruses from making their way back from the plant to our farms. Secondly, truck washes and transport, it's a major topic when it comes to enteric coronaviruses. We simply don't have enough truck washes as an industry today to get everything washed, even if we wanted to. That's a conversation on U.S. ship as well. The use of recycled water within these truck washes is something that I think needs to be researched on. We need to do some work on that. Most commercial truck wash locations use recycled water. Without adequate disinfection and drying of these trucks and trailers after being washed, we're likely to assume that it's clean, but potentially it's not. So what can we do more with the commercial truck washes and transport in general? The last thing, I guess, here I'd talk about would be contract labor. I think it needs to be a focus when it comes to mitigating the spread of enteric coronaviruses. I've seen some contract labor crews here this season, just within our system that we're moving around PED and Delta Corona, with just the lack of basic biosecurity on the farm. They're a huge influence to spreading disease from site to site. There's more and more contract labor coming into our pig barns. The trend's going to continue, and we need to address the contract relationship, facilitating trainings there, setting expectations, and ultimately having some shared responsibility to achieve buy-in with these industry partners on the SLAT level. It's a topic that I don't think that we can ignore at this point. They're a part of the puzzle and just something we need to address as an industry. From a system perspective, so I talked about some big industry things like what we can do, but just from the system perspective, what can we impact on these three key issues that I just described? How can we mitigate enteric coronaviruses within the system? Ensuring transport trailers are effectively washed during high-risk months is a strategy that is employed by several large production systems to reduce enteric virus breaks. Employing specific and seasonal strategies for disinfecting sites between turns, whether that's whitewashing or an additional disinfection step, just basic inspection of the barns after they are claimed to be clean, training, developing, coaching people in the field on best biosecurity practices to reduce transmission of viruses, and really focusing on site-specific biosecurity measures to prevent disease entry. So yes, very complex, and we have a tremendous opportunity because we're starting at ground zero.
I like your comment that the approach on system level and on the national level, right? Because those are correlated, most of the systems, the way that we are developing the swine industry over the years, that led to the problems that we have today, right? A couple of packing plants where we are commingling a lot of trucks, not a lot of infrastructure for truck wash on those, and also sharing labor for some specific areas. So controlling the system, and that will help on the national level infrastructure. Those are connected, right? So I like your comment on that.
Totally. It starts with the system and the individual producer, and that all moves out to the rest of the industry.
Yeah.
This is a very good discussion topic, and you bring a lot of things for us to think about here. But I want to pick up your brain now from enteric coronavirus to PERS. If you look for PERS virus, we know that is a huge problem in the industry, and that is always this emerging strain that comes through and causes problems like the lineage 1C.5. Start in Minnesota, spread to different regions. As example, when you enter in Missouri, it caused a problem. Now it's 75% of all the wild type strains detected there. Move to east is a problem in Ohio now. We just have the first detection in South Carolina. But on the other hand, we have other PERS virus strains like lineage 1H. That's still a huge problem in Oklahoma and Kansas that keep burning those farms there. So why do you think that is this detection dynamics of PERS virus across different regions and what contribute for that? That's one question that I have for you on PERS. And then I have a follow-up question for you that what would be the non-negotiable practices that you could apply in your system or other systems out there to avoid this multiple PERS virus strains detection and activity?
Okay. I think it's a very interesting question that you're posing here, and the one that's very close to my heart today, as our Midwest system has broke with lineage 1C viruses this season in both Iowa and Illinois sow farms for the very first time. Mm-hmm. We've been dealing with a lot of lineage 1A and lineage 1H viruses, and here this season we've had those devastating 1C viruses, and it's hitting close to home, this question. I think the progression of the lineage 1C virus might offer us some insight on how these viruses move within a region. It was first described in Minnesota and northern Iowa. The lineage 1C virus I've seen progressing south and infiltrating new territories as described, especially with that South Carolina case. That's far from Minnesota and Iowa. Speaking from my own experience, we saw the lineage 1C virus as initially diagnosed in our northernmost grow out sites in the system, which are north of Interstate Highway 80 in Iowa. So up in the first described region, they weren't moving really south too much. As time has progressed, we've seen those lineage 1C viruses move south, persist in new regions. So they just kind of slowly progress down the state, down into southern, southeast Iowa for us, and then even into Missouri. So we've seen those viruses move south, and you wonder about regional spread and how that's happening. These lineage 1C viruses, they've recently just emerged within the industry. It demonstrates how PERS continues to adapt and finds a way to infect the host. Mm-hmm. These viruses, they're extremely virulent. They've overtaken other lineages. We've seen these 1C viruses more commonly diagnosed now versus the 1A or the 1H. So I think they've just overtaken those other lineages, as you've described in Missouri, with 75% of the cases being lineage 1C viruses at this point. It just shows how virulent and how much that's overpowering these other lineages. As we think about the PERS viruses' regional differences, I think we need to evaluate how the pigs are moved. You asked why Oklahoma and Kansas specifically have the majority of their cases as lineage 1H virus and not yet have seen the 1C. I think there's two reasons there why we haven't seen those viruses make their way even further south. The sow farms in these regions have not yet been infected by the lineage 1C virus as first and foremost, so they're continuing to produce those lineage 1H pigs. Mm-hmm. Producers tend to place pigs in regions as close as they can to the sow farms that are producing them. So most of the pigs that are placed into grow outs in those regions are going to be placed from those sow farms producing those lineage 1H pigs. So we're not typically moving pigs from outside of the region into the south. We typically move the pigs where the corn is grown and typically further north. Mm. So on that comment, pigs are generally moved out of Oklahoma and Kansas for their grow out and their offspring, and very few pigs are moved into Oklahoma and Kansas for their grow out. So transportation, pig movement, it's a huge piece of the puzzle when it comes to tracking how these viruses are spread across the regions. You asked a second question on non-negotiables.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So as far as non-negotiable practices go to avoid multiple PRRS strains in a system, I think it's a much more difficult question for me to answer because it's dependent on the region where the pigs are located. Mm-hmm. So for me, if pigs are located in a hog dense area with PRRS breaks every 12 to 18 months, mainly due to aerosolization, we're going to approach those sites much differently than we do sites that are located in more pig remote regions with a lower risk of aerosol transmission. So working in a large production system that services both pigs in hog dense and hog remote regions, we do unfortunately live with multiple PRRS viruses at any given time due to the shedding, life cycle, and duration of the virus, sow farms overlapping with their breaks. But all that being said, I guess going back to your question, some advice, some non-negotiables that I would give even managing a system with multiple viruses is, number one, always have a plan. Viral infections in a farm must be actively managed. The pathogens continue to find ways to survive and thrive in our pig populations. So having a very solid plan of attack is important to combating the viruses, and it can be very farm specific. Mm-hmm. Medications, vaccines, management practices, they all play into PRRS planning. And I think this can be coordinated with your veterinarian, but don't ignore it. Don't not have a plan. The plan can change every year, even month to month, but always have a plan of attack because you're dealing with an active live organism that's going to change and going to find a way to persist. Secondly, have a good diagnostic understanding of the virus. And I continue to learn here as, you know, new tests and diagnostics become available. So utilizing all the tools that we have available today, continuing to evolve your diagnostic requests and sampling as these new tools become available, as the viruses continue to adapt and evolve, I think it's important to collect the best information that we can and utilize that most modern diagnostic tool to understand the PRRS viruses we're dealing with. So today, if a sow farm breaks in our system, we quickly pull serum, we process it, we store it in an in-house ultra-low negative 80 freezer in high quantities for future use. Then we send off the sample to the diagnostic lab. They complete a PRRS PCR with quantitation. We understand how viremic the sample is. They ORF5 sequence it, and then we complete a whole genome sequence now to have available to compare to future samples that might allow us to understand how this virus is evolving over time. And that's something that I didn't do when I first started my job in 2016. So just in the short, less than a decade, right? And here we are already having new diagnostic tools available. The last thing we do, we isolate the PRRS virus for any potential future vaccine use. So the tools we have today are much more specific. They continue to improve over time. I think it's best practice to adapt and gather the very best and most specific information we can to understand these viruses and continue to learn, because we have a lot of learning to do.
That's awesome. Just a quick follow-up question on when you say that when you sequence the viruses, do you manage the viruses differently based on how what virus you have? Or do you sequence more to understand if it's a new break versus completely, you know, if it's the same virus that's circulating in the herd? How are you using that sequence information today for in that regard of responding to the outbreak?
That's a great question. So we use it in many different ways. First, you asked, you know, does it change our management practices? And absolutely. I've seen it in our production system as well as others. This lineage 1C virus is so virulent when it starts to hit the sow farm. I've seen several production systems, you know, taking out 6 weeks of pigs and just not weaning any pigs for a period of time because they do so poorly in the nursery phase. And the decision has to be an economic one. You know, do you put those pigs on feed, or is our mortality going to be so extreme? And we can kind of predict that from the sequencing and comparison to others in the industry and what their experience has been. So yes, we would change our management practices depending on that sequence. We also use that whole genome sequencing to compare to others, try to find the source of the virus. see if we can find any links or where we contracted it. We found some cases here with whole genome sequencing where we found 100% match to another farm outside of our system. And you know, you wonder, 100% match, that virus must have been tracked directly to the farm, like feces or blood right into a pig on our farm. So you wonder about that. And the whole genome sequence is certainly helpful there, because you're not just getting that ORF5. And if you find 100% match on the whole genome, you're like, yep, that's probably it. Thirdly, we're using those whole genome sequences or sequence attempts just to track the virus over time. If they're hard to eliminate, the way that we're managing the virus, if we see an increase in abortions or other production losses, we can pull serum again and compare it against that original strain and see if it's changing or going through some recombination. So those are kind of the three ways that we use that sequencing. And I mean, it's a great tool. You always have it. It's in your database forever. Like I said, things continue to evolve over time. So let's just use the best diagnostics that we can and use them to our best of ability management and comparison wise.
Very good. That was fantastic discussion. I hope you guys saved this podcast.
I will. Really good. I will.
Thank you, Dr. Glozeski, for joining us today. It was a really good discussion, as I mentioned. Glad to have you here and hope you come back soon.
Anytime you extend the invitation. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. That was it for this month, and I see you guys next month. Thank you.